Thanks. I didn't know how that was supposed to be. We're talking about the beast in chapter 11 of the book of Revelation, and we noted that the beast is introduced here in verse 7 for the first time in the book of Revelation, but just mentioned with a definite article, as though it should be familiar to the people who were reading this book for the first time. The beast that ascendeth out of the bottomless pit, or the abyss. And indeed, they did understand what this was about, because they'd read about it in the book of Daniel that they'd had all their lives. There were four beasts in the seventh chapter of Daniel. They knew that they were living under the fourth one, because they understood that the previous three empires had passed away. And they were very interested in this fourth beast, because it was persecuting them in 96 AD when this was written. And they were also interested in that little horn that comes out of the fourth beast. And this supplementary section of the book of Revelation, the little scroll section, is mainly about that. It's a little book about the little horn. So we were talking about that last night, and we had gone to the point where we were talking about the fact that the beast killed the witnesses from the church that were attempting to teach the true Word of God. And we talked about the development of this, and I was just about to give you some historical information about the development of this persecution. We saw that the state church was started under Constantine in the 4th century when we studied the 6th chapter a couple of years ago. We also started that the papacy began early in the 6th century, filling the power vacuum that was left when the Western Roman Empire collapsed under the barbarian invasions. But we also saw that when the papacy first began, there was not a lot of ability on its part to persecute anybody, because it didn't have the political power yet. It took till the 12th century for this to really develop, when the papacy had taken over the churches in all of these countries, taken over the national state churches in all of these countries. Then the spiritual power was able to subject the political power and to make statements about inquisitions and so forth. So I was just going to give you a little bit of information about that with regard to these witnesses being killed. In 1163 AD, Pope Alexander III forbade giving refuge to the so-called Albigensian heretics, forbade buying and selling with them, and otherwise communicating with them. In 1179, an anathema was pronounced against the Cathari, the Paterini, the Publicani, and other heretics, forbidding the provision of harbor to them and forbidding them Christian burial. We saw that many of these groups referred to themselves as churches of Christ, but their enemies referred to them either by the names of the people whom they were following, their leaders, or sometimes referred to them by names referenced to the places where they lived or to some of the practices that they had. So there were dozens of different names that were applied to these people, but they were people who were attempting to follow the Word of God. In 1183, Pope Lucius III pronounced anathema against the Cathari, the Paterini, the Ardaldisti, the Humiliati, the Poor Men of Lyons, and he used the word Inquisition for the first time in 1183 for the detection and suppression of the so-called heretics. In 1198, Pope Innocent III called for using the arms of the people and the prince as necessary to stamp out heresy, and he established the Spanish Inquisition. In 1215, all the former plans were reiterated for the extirpation of heresy. The secular powers were expressly subordinated to the spiritual power for this purpose, and these crusaders were rewarded with every kind of papal indulgence and every privilege, just as were the crusaders to the Holy Land. In 1227 and 1229, even children were required to denounce any whom they knew to be heretics, and the scriptures were prohibited to the laity. And we could go on and on with this, but I think you get the idea. In 1234, 1235, 1236, 1242, 1244, more councils, more papal bulls directed the war against the witnesses. And then in 1244, the bull of Innocent IV directed that if mercy was shown to those who were sentenced to be burned, that at least you had to cut their tongues out to prevent the possibility of future blasphemy. This war continued on against any and against all who taught the New Testament message against the heresies of Roman Catholicism through the 14th and 15th century, including people like Wycliffe in England, Huss in Bohemia, which is now part of the Czech Republic, and their followers. What does it mean that the witnesses were killed? Well, millions of them actually died. But the language here seems to speak primarily of the cessation of their witness. They were killed in the sense that their witness was squelched. When the surviving Bohemian churches finally, in 1499, sent out deputies to search throughout Europe to see if they could find anybody of like precious faith, they found nobody. Nobody who was worshiping as they were. The Roman Catholic historian, Cardinal Pevoredcini, reported that in the West, the true faith, and by true faith he means the Roman Catholic faith, in the West the true faith flourished with scarce a contamination attaching to it, there remaining only almost invisible certain minute strains of ignoble and despised heresies, followed by a little flock of rustic and rude men, the remnant either of the Waldenses or of the followers of John Huss, who had been condemned and burnt a century before. The Protestant historian Mosheim states, as the 16th century began, no danger seemed to threaten the pontiffs, meaning the popes. For those grievous commotions which had been raised in the preceding centuries by the Waldenses, the Albigenses, the Beggards, and others, and afterward by the Bohemians, had been suppressed and extinguished by the sword and by crafty management. The Waldenses who survived fared hard and had few resources. Those Bohemians who were displeased with the Romish doctrine from their want of power and their ignorance could attempt nothing and therefore were rather despised than feared. And finally, on May the 5th, 1514, in the Fifth Lateran Council, the following announcement was proclaimed to Pope Leo X. The statement was made to Pope Leo X, there is an end to the resistance to papal rule. There is an end of resistance to the papal rule and religion. Opposers there exist no more. Another statement was made to him on that same occasion. The whole body of Christendom is now seen to be subjected to its head, that is, to thee, to you, Pope Leo X. I believe this is the fulfillment of the predicted death of the witnesses, that there was an end of resistance to papal rule. Now, I don't mean that the Lord's church had ceased to exist here. I think ever since the Lord established the church, he said the gates of Hades would not prevail against it, and he has never been a shepherd without a sheep. He's never been a head without a body. He's never been a king without a kingdom. But they were reduced to such poor circumstances in the areas ruled by the Church of Rome that they weren't being heard from at this time, and that's why the Catholics could say there is an end of resistance to papal rule. The church was not strong enough to be seen to resist. The witnesses to the New Testament message were silenced for 3.5 years until finally Martin Luther posted his 95 Theses for Debate on the door of the Wittenberg Cathedral on October 31st, 1517. That is 3.5 years, and that latter date begins the Protestant Reformation of the 16th century. That this is 3.5 years is based on a calculation of a 360-day symbolic year. We know that because 3.5 years, say 3.5 symbolic years, is called 1,260 days in 11:13 and 42 months in 13 verse 5. This corresponds from the time of the ninth session of the Fifth Lateran Council on May the 5th, 1514, to Luther's posting his theses on October 31st, 1517. If we want to be specific about calculating these dates, from May the 5th to the 31st is 27 days, then 30 days in June, 31 in July, 31 in August, 30 in September, and 31 in October with inclusive reckoning, which is the way that reckoning was done in the first century when this was written. And you add that up, it comes to 180 plus the 3 years of 360, 1080 more days for a total of 1260 days. So it turns out to be just exactly the 360-day symbolic prophetic years. The punishments for heresy included all of the measures that were imposed by the former papal bulls and councils, including the prohibition of burial, which is mentioned here in the chapter as we read last night. The bodies were left, rather than being buried, they were left to be ravished by wild animals, or if burned, sometimes the ashes were cast into rivers or lakes. In verse 10, we read about them that dwell upon the earth shall rejoice over them. They're rejoicing over the dead witnesses and shall make merry and shall send gifts to one another. David Piraeus, who lived in this 16th century, wrote that when the heretics are burnt, papists play at frolicsome games, they celebrate feasts and banquets, they sing Te Deum Laudamus and wish one another joy. At the close of the Fifth Lateran Council, there was great celebration. Pope Leo X said, "All actions of the council considered, our soul exults in the Lord, and we judge that thanks should be given to God for it, and that among all the faithful in Christ, there should be those signs of joy which on similar occasions are wont to be observed." And this was followed by a plenary papal indulgence, the singing of the Te Deum, and lavish banqueting. In verses 11 through 13, as the witnesses are a symbol for the church, which teaches the New Testament, and the death of the witnesses is a figure for the cessation of that witness, so the resurrection of the witnesses must be a figure for the resumption of that witness. This predicts that the life function of witnessing of the church is going to be restored here. This resurrection symbol is used that same way in the 37th chapter of the book of Ezekiel. All of us know about the Ezekiel's vision of the valley of the dry bones. It didn't look like they could live, but yet they did live. Resurrection is used by extra-biblical literature, literature outside the Bible, as a figure for revival as well. So we have it in the Old Testament, we have it in non-biblical literature as well. The 1260 years forecast for their witness have a point of their death, at the point of their death, have not yet expired yet. They are given some sort of ascendancy to authority here, though. At the time of the Reformation, some of the Protestant churches become national churches, and so they're not going to be persecuted as they had been in the past. The acts of Satan against the Lord's work were limited and are limited by the Lord's providential control. It talks here about a severe earthquake and the collapse of a tenth part of the city. Tenth part of the city as in the great city, that is the Papal Roman Empire. This should be taken, I think, to represent some revolution in government in the Roman world. And Kevin last night was mentioning the printing of the Bible and so forth, and I think that comes in here, the printing of the Bible. Because the first book of any size to be printed with movable type was by Gutenberg in 1456. Gutenberg printed 100 copies of the Latin Vulgate on vellum. Cheryl just walked in. She encouraged me when I was over at Nixa last month to go up to the passages display in Springfield. Nadine financed that for me, so we got both of them here tonight. That was really an interesting thing. I don't know if any of the rest of you saw it or not, but I know a few of you did. And they had a replica there of Gutenberg's original printing press, which was very interesting to see. I think young people in particular would or could enjoy that type of thing. Only three perfect copies of Gutenberg's original Latin Vulgate Bible remain, to my knowledge. One of them was purchased by the United States government in 1930 for over $350,000, which was a lot of money back in the beginning stages of the Depression. But they bought it for that, and it's kept now in the Library of Congress. At the time of Gutenberg, when he was successful, 1,000 printers sprang up overnight. 30,000 books were printed almost overnight. The invention of the printing press using movable type allowed the widespread distribution of the Bible, and it would be hard to overemphasize it as an important thing that happened back in that 15th century. The Word of God had been locked up in the dead Latin language for so long, or forbidden to be read, and the translation of the Bible into the common languages, into the English by William Tyndale, into the German by Luther himself, and into the other languages of Europe, allowed for an explosion of biblical learning. The Bible was read for the first time in centuries by the common people, and those who searched the Scriptures could not find their religion. And when they searched their religion, they couldn't find the Scriptures. And so something had to happen here. You couldn't put the genie back in the Bible, in the bottle once the Bible had been printed. Preachers of the gospel sprang up in support of change. The witnesses being caught up to heaven, I believe, refers to their being protected by political authority and gaining independence from the Church of Rome. Political ascendancy was given to Protestantism in parts of Germany, and soon that was followed by other countries as well. Now, the witnesses were still in sackcloth. That's an important point, because the Inquisition still continued in Italy and Spain and Portugal and elsewhere. In some cases, the Inquisition continued on for hundreds of years after this. But the witnesses in the Holy Roman Empire gained a political status which protected them from the papal inquisitors, whose practice it was to rely on the political authorities. They relied on the political authorities to carry out their punishments. They would pronounce the sentence and then leave it to the political people to actually burn them or whatever the punishment was going to be. So the ascension in a cloud here, I believe, enabled the Reformation to continue with some kind of power in a less persecuted area. The cloud is the symbol for the divine presence. And the severe earthquake that is mentioned here, I believe, is the political revolution that accompanied the Reformation. Remember, these were national churches, and there was a whole lot of politics involved. Even people like Luther got involved in a lot of politics. But there's a severe earthquake, a tenth part of the city falls. A tenth part is a tithe. A tithe is acknowledgement that the whole is really supposed to be viewed as belonging to the Lord. The whole church is supposed to be the Lord's, but they had hijacked it with a great apostasy that took it away from the Lord. And we'll see more about this, I think, in chapter 12. The tenth part here in chapter 11 may be intended to indicate God's right to the entire city. It really, the whole church was supposed to belong to him. And I think the angel setting his right foot on the sea and his left foot on the land may be intended to kind of indicate that God is supposed to be in control of the whole thing. That when we talk about the tenth part of the city falling, we're talking about the city which is composed of the 10 nations of Europe, and one of those nations fell so far as Roman Catholic power was concerned. And that nation, of course, the first nation out of that 10-nation bloc was obviously England. I think we're all aware of that. It was one of the 10 nations of the great city, but it withdrew from the great city by an act of parliament in 1534. Why would this happen in England? Well, I think you all know the story of Henry VIII, one of the most famous of the British kings. The Pope had earlier given Henry VIII the title of Defender of the Faith. And by the way, the British monarch today is still regarded as the Defender of the Faith. Queen Elizabeth II, as she sits on the throne of England today, has as one of her titles Defender of the Faith. The reason this was given to Henry is because in 1521, Henry VIII had come forth as the champion of the papacy to dispute with Luther. And Henry forwarded to Rome a copy of the treatise in which he supposedly refuted and defeated Martin Luther. Leo X therefore dubbed Henry Defender of the Faith. And as I said, Queen Elizabeth bears that title now. She likes that title. Prince Charles, her son and heir apparent, wants the title changed to just Defender of Faith. He doesn't want it to be Defender of the Faith, because that's too specific for him. He just wants it to be Defender of Faith, so it can include Muslims or Hindus or anybody else that has faith. You can check out what he has to say about that at princeofwales.gov if you're interested in what Prince Charles has to say. I think this may be one of the reasons why his mother doesn't let him be king. I don't know if that's right or not, but I hope she never does. I'm not ready for him just to be Defender of Faith. And I think she stands an excellent chance of breaking Queen Victoria's record, because although she is 88 years old, her mother lived to be over 100. So I'm hoping that Queen Elizabeth does, to the extent that I care about it at all. I'm hoping that Queen Elizabeth lives a lot longer. Anyway, the fall of the tenth part of the city was occasioned by Henry VIII, who, even though the Pope called him the Defender of the Faith, wanted to divorce his wife, Catherine of Aragon, and marry another girl by the name of Anne Boleyn. The Pope wouldn't let him, so Henry did it anyway, and Parliament abolished Roman authority in England and declared the King of England to be the head of the English Church. Now, the English church didn't really change very much. It was still Catholic in everything except its connection to... There were two things changed, basically. They weren't connected to Rome anymore, and they stopped having to send their money south of the Alps. But the Anglican church stayed pretty much as it had been otherwise, although it was simplified a little bit. But this was quite a political earthquake at the time. The Reformation churches, as we've said, were still national churches. There was a whole lot of politics involved here. In the earthquake, 7,000 of men were slain. Now, that's interestingly put down there in the latter part, in verse 13, in the middle of verse 13, that 7,000, in the original, it's 7,000 were slain. Thousands. In the plural. Kind of like we have back in Micah chapter 5, verse 2, "Thou Bethlehem Ephratah, though thou be little among the thousands in Judah," thousands with an S on the end, because it had a special meaning. In the Septuagint of Micah 5, 2, the word is kiliads in the Greek of the Septuagint. Anyway, the thousands had a special meaning, could refer to tribal districts, as the number indicating divisions of the Israelite tribes came to represent the territory assigned for them in the land of Canaan. So the same expression was used later on. These districts, which are plural, with the specific number 7, suggest a collective entity. Personally, I think that this is referring to the 7 districts which formed the Dutch Union of Utrecht in 1579. And if you want to be specific about that, there are the 7 that formed that Dutch Union: Holland, Zeeland, Utrecht, Friesland, Groninger, Overijssel, and Gelderland. Together, these 7 formed this compatible union. And it was a uniting of these Protestant provinces. That's the point. They are Protestant provinces uniting. So this was the death of 7,000 in that they were lost to the great city. In addition to losing the whole British Empire, they also lost these 7,000 that are mentioned here. So in a few verses here, long story short, we're given a prediction of the Reformation of the 16th century. Verse 14, as I think I said last night, functions in the little scroll message to show the synchronism between the time of the great earthquake and the end of the sixth trumpet prophecy. The sixth trumpet prophecy is a part of the seven-sealed scroll, which we have in the main thrust of the core of the book of Revelation. This that we're in right now is supplementary material, and this 14th verse shows how these two synchronize together. The third woe yet to come is going to be the bowl prophecies, which follow immediately after the little scroll supplement, or appendix or digression, however you want to think of it. The bowl prophecies are described in chapter 15, verse 1, as the 7 last plagues last because with them God's wrath is completed. We've seen that the Ottoman Turks finally succeeded in conquering Constantinople in 1453. But they didn't stop there. The Muslim Turkish armies continued on to enlarge their empire until a decisive sea battle, the Battle of Lampanto, which was fought in 1571. This is just 8 years before the insurrection of the 7 Dutch provinces, which I was speaking of a moment ago, in 1579. So we just have 8-year difference here, and this shows the compatibility or the synchronicity of these two scrolls, the big scroll and the little scroll that we're studying. We have a synchronization here between the events that are forecast in one and the events that are forecast in the other for the time of the sixth trumpet. Then we go on to verses 15 through 19. Here we have a proliptic scene. We have heavenly voices celebrating as if they cannot be restrained. They are celebrating the victory that is implicit in the announcement of the last trumpet and looking forward to the events that are going to be amplified in the 7 bowls. At several junctures in the book of Revelation, we look ahead proleptically to the scenes of bliss in the future, to the end time culmination of things, just to make it easier to stomach the persecution that was coming. If you can have something to look forward to, then it's easier to be faithful unto death. The 7 trumpet sounds immediately after the announcement of the third woe. There is an ominous anticipation of the bowls of wrath, which are going to be hard on everybody, and that warrants these hymns of praise here in the little horn message before we get into telling about the development of the beast, where that came from and how. Notice that the future victory is in the past tense, as we so often have. When we use past tense to show a promise as certain for the future, it's written as though it's already happened, and yet it's going to be something in the future. Then in Hebrew grammar, this figurative construction in the Old Testament was known as the prophetic perfect. You may have heard that phrase before. And we're very familiar with it, I think, in the Old Testament, that a prediction that might be hundreds of years into the future is given in the past tense. Maybe one of the best known examples of that for us would be the 53rd chapter of the book of Isaiah. In Isaiah 53, the first 9 verses or so, it's in the past tense, even though everybody knows it's not going to happen for 700 years. It's talking about the crucifixion of the Messiah, Jesus Christ, but yet Isaiah is writing it 700 years before Christ, and he says, he was bruised for our transgressions. He was bruised for our iniquity. It's all in the past tense there in the first part of that chapter. Well, this is similar to that. It's the prophetic perfect, a proleptic look ahead that uses past tense because when God says something, it's just as sure to happen as if it's already happened. That's the idea here in the tenses, I think. Also here in verses 15 through 19, we have the 24 elders, angelic beings representing the saints of both testaments, praise the Lord God Almighty, who is and who was, and in some of the manuscripts, that last phrase, and who is to come, is omitted. And I think we can understand why, because this reflects the prophetic orientation of the hymn. If we're talking about something that comes at the consummation of all things, then there is no is to come, because the eternal era is going to be the last one, where we'll be with God forever. So we don't have to say who is to come. His people will no longer in need of looking forward to their redemption because they will already be experiencing it. At the end of the chapter, the temple is open, and after 1,000 years of dominance by the Roman papacy, back to the Bible movements continue to spread around the world and more centered toward a restoration of things. We'll see more of that, Lord willing, in the future. Verse 19 is a transition statement connecting the prophecy of the two witnesses with the sounding of the seventh trumpet. I think if you have any questions on chapter 11, this would be a good time for them. If not, we'll just go on and take a look at chapter 12. Chapter 12 and 13 together, really, are written to tell us about the nature of the little horn. And this beast that's mentioned in verse 7 of the preceding chapter. It's just put out there because the people already had the book of Daniel. They knew something about the fourth beast of Daniel in chapter 7 and that little horn that was going to come out of it. But now we're going to see the development of that little horn over time, how it comes to be in chapters 12 and 13. Jesus directed the message of the book of Revelation to persecuted Christians at the end of the first century. They're really the focus of this, and we need to look at it through their eyes as much as we can, while at the same time seeing what further clarification and enlightenment we can have, since there's been a number of centuries since they lived. These were Christians in the first century who had reason to fear the predicted war of the little horn anti-Christian power that was forecast in the seventh chapter of Daniel. That horn was explicitly said in Daniel 7 to make war with the saints. Well, we're the saints and we're having trouble with Domitian, the emperor, cruel persecuting tyrant. And so we saw the presentation of the little scroll in chapter 10 and an introduction to the war against the saints in chapter 11. Now we come to a veiled or symbolic disclosure of the nature of the evil forces represented by the little horn and some indication of the course of the war that the little horn fights against the saints. Basically, chapters 12 and 13 expand on chapter 11. Chapter 12 introduces the satanic dragon power, which precedes the rise of the little horn beast, but which eventually gives its power and gives authority to the beast in chapter 13. So we'll have a change of symbols there for a very specific reason. We're expanding events here in the book of Revelation of things which shall be hereafter. Come up here and I'll show you things which shall be hereafter. Things yet to come, chapter 1, verse 19, chapter 4, verse 1, chapter 5, verse 1. That scroll was about things that were going to come in the future. The future from when? The future from 96 A.D. So we're not going to find information here that takes us in back of 96 A.D. This is from 96 A.D. on that these things are being revealed. We saw the very first seal started in 96 A.D., just very briefly, after John finished writing the book of Revelation. So everything we see here should be after 96 A.D. I want to try to read this prophecy as it should have been understood by the Christians at the time when it was written, as much as we're capable of doing that. things that must be hereafter from the point of view of those people who first read this. So I'm going to just take the time here to read chapter 12 so that we all have it in front of our minds, because I know you've had busy days, you've been thinking about lots of other things. Let's just get this scripture together in our minds. There appeared a great wonder in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun and the moon under her feet, and upon her head a crown of 12 stars. And she, being with child, cried, travailing in birth and pain to be delivered. And there appeared another wonder in heaven, and behold, a great red dragon, having 7 heads and 10 horns and 7 crowns upon his heads. And his tail drew a third part of the stars of heaven, and did cast them to the earth. And the dragon stood before the woman, which was ready to be delivered, for to devour her child as soon as it was born. And she brought forth a man-child, who was to rule all the nations with the rod of iron. And her child was caught up unto God and to his throne. And the woman fled into the wilderness, where she hath a place prepared of God, that they should feed her there 1,260 days. And there was war in heaven. Michael and his angels fought against the dragon, and the dragon fought and his angels, and prevailed not, neither was their place found any more in heaven. And the great dragon was cast out, that old serpent called the devil and Satan, which deceiveth the whole world. He was cast out into the earth, and his angels were cast out with him. And I heard a loud voice saying in heaven, Now is come salvation and strength, and the kingdom of our God, and the power of his Christ, for the accuser of our brethren is cast down, which accused them before our God day and night. And they overcame him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony, and they loved not their lives unto the death. Therefore rejoice, ye heavens, and ye that dwell in them. Woe to the inhabitants of the earth and of the sea, for the devil is come down unto you, having great wrath, because he knoweth that he hath but a short time. And when the dragon saw that he was cast unto the earth, he persecuted the woman which brought forth the man-child. And to the woman were given 2 wings of a great eagle, that she might fly into the wilderness, into her place, where she is nourished for a time, and times, and half a time, from the face of the serpent. And the serpent cast out of his mouth water as a flood after the woman, that he might cause her to be carried away of the flood. And the earth helped the woman, and the earth opened her mouth and swallowed up the flood which the dragon cast out of his mouth. And the dragon was wroth with the woman, and went to make war with the remnant of her seed, which keep the commandments of God, and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. The woman, I believe, is the symbol of the true visible church. By visible church, we mean what you and I look at when we look at the Lord's church. Just like you would look at a congregation here, your congregation has a membership list, and that's the visible church to us, since we don't read human minds. The real church is what God sees when he looks at the church, the ones who are actually in it according to his view of it. You and I don't know about each other. Sometimes we can deceive ourselves to the place where we don't really know about ourselves. But by visible church, I just mean what humans look at when they look at the church, what seems to be the church of the Lord at any given time. In chapter 12, verse 17, we see the offspring of the woman are those who keep the commandments and hold to the testimony of Jesus. The bride metaphor for this woman is entirely appropriate, because Old Testament Israel has her fulfillment in the church, as you know. In verse 1, I think it kind of connects Joseph's dream of the sun, moon, and stars to what's being written here, because the sun, moon, and stars, whether it's in Genesis, Revelation, or anywhere symbolic in between, refer to important personages, VIP type of people. Eusebius, in his Ecclesiastical History, Book 10, Chapter 4, talking about the revolution which occurred in the time of Constantine and his Edict of Toleration, says that those that were of his friends and of his household, he advanced not only to glory with all men, but now also with celestial powers, the sun, the moon, and the stars, the whole heavens and the world. So that now, what never happened before, the supreme sovereigns, Constantine and Licinius, sensible of the honor conferred upon them by him, ridicule the ancient delusions of their ancestors, that's paganism, this was the time of the fall of paganism, and they acknowledge only the one and true God. So he has the sun, moon, and stars connected with the glory of the church at the time of Constantine. Sun, moon, and stars are oriental hyperbole for the powers that be, the VIPs. in a little document called the Testament of Abraham, a Jewish writing dated about 100 A.D. It relates a dream in which Abraham is represented by the sun and Isaac is represented by the moon. And in the dream, Isaac has the sun with its rays resting on his head. So this kind of terminology and symbolic language was not unusual at all. In Revelation 12, from the standpoint of the first century reader, a future time is predicted for the people of God who were now, in John's day, they were outcasts both from Judaism and from pagan Rome. They were undergoing persecution. But there was a time projected here when the church was going to come into a new and radiant standing by association with a high governmental power. That seems to be what is predicted here. This must be a time when, sometimes I forget that to push these buttons here. This must be a time future to the writing of Revelation. That's why I think this cannot be the birth of Christ, even though I have taught it that way, and maybe you have, and maybe you will in the future. But I don't see how it can be the birth of Christ, because that would cause us to have to go back 100 years. There's nowhere else in the book of Revelation that we go back before 96 A.D. like that, and I don't think it's necessary to postulate it here. I think there are some things about having the man-child be Christ that just don't fit too well with the information that we're given here in chapter 12. The moon under the woman's feet indicated to the first century reader that the woman was to exercise influence over whatever is indicated by the moon. Commonly, ancient rulers spoke of conquered people as being under their feet, and she's got something under her feet here. And we have this in the Bible, Psalm 47, verse 3. He subdued nations under us, peoples under our feet. And we have it in the New Testament, 1 Corinthians 15, 25. He must reign until he hath put all enemies under his feet. At the Temple of Luxor in Egypt, the seated statues of Ramses II show his feet resting on footstools on which are engraved images of bound captives of war. They were under his feet. So this stands true in pagan symbolism, in biblical symbolism. It just seems to be true across the board. The subjection of the moon to the authority of the woman by being under her feet goes along with the view that the sun represents temporal authority, the primary authority in the temporal sphere. The woman is clothed with the sun, suggesting that she is associated as a recipient or the beneficiary of the good graces of governmental authority. This is a temporal condition that was going to reverse the state of the church as it existed in the time of the Apostle John in the end of the first century when he's writing this. The pains of childbirth refer to a future time of severe persecution against the people of God, shown by her crying out in pain. And this condition of the woman does not represent the circumstances preceding the birth of Jesus. The Jews were in peace under the Romans, but in peace in the years preceding the birth of Jesus. The covenant people were not undergoing severe persecution or suffering at the time that Jesus was born. The Jews were then allowing the Romans, were allowed by the Romans to live in peace. So I think this fits better with a time a little later on, after 96 A.D. In verse 3, we have the great red dragon with 7 heads and 10 horns and 7 crowns on his head. He's got 10 horns just like the fourth Roman beast back in Daniel 7. I have said repeatedly that I think the book of Revelation is primarily an expanded commentary on Daniel chapter 7. And if we look at it that way, I think it helps a lot of things fall into place. Those who read the Apocalypse first would have had to identify this evil power with Rome. The purple-red dragon was one of Rome's military ensigns, but wasn't common until the 3rd century, which I think is a significant thing. It wasn't even used at all until the close of the 2nd century, or near the close of it, and it wasn't common until the 3rd century. Here we see the devil acting in the pagan Roman Empire, and inspiring the pagan Roman Empire. That empire acted openly as an agent of Satan, first against Christ through Herod and Pilate, and then against the servants of Christ through emperors like Nero and Diocletian. They weren't trying to pretend to be Christians at all. They were adamantly and openly opposed against the Christians. Now, in the 17th chapter of the book of Revelation, and it's hard to study chapters 12 and 13 without also studying chapter 17. Really, by the time you get to chapter 17, you've already studied it, because so much of that needs to be brought in here. In chapter 17, verse 19, we see that the seven heads are seven kingdoms, seven mountains which represent kingdoms, seven kings or kingdoms. We learn from that passage that in John's day, five had already fallen. One was current when the prophecy was given, and one at that time was still future. And we'll talk more about that later on in chapter 13, Lord willing. The statement of the horns are important here. Horns were symbols of authority or power, just like the horns on a steer are where his power really is. My grandpa used to be a cowboy down in Texas, and he said, just don't get off your horse when you're around those longhorn steers, because they would gore right through you and not think a thing about it. The power is in their horns, and that's why a horn is the symbol of power. The ten horns correspond to the ten horns on the Roman beast of Daniel chapter 7, verse 7. They represent ten kings or kingdoms who will come from this Roman kingdom, and that is made clear in Daniel 7:24. The word kings in the Aramaic of Daniel 7:24 should be understood to mean kingdoms, as in chapter 7, verse 17 of the book of Daniel. The seven crowns on his head are diadem crowns, and that's an important point. There's two kinds of crowns talked about in the book of Revelation. Back in chapter 6, when we saw Nerwah, we saw that he had a crown, but it was a stephanos, a laurel wreath crown, which was what was in use in the time when John wrote the book and when Nerwah became the first emperor that was predicted in the book under the first seal. But the diadem crown was something different altogether. The diadem crown represented absolute power, the badge of Asiatic royalty. These were used in Persian monarchs at the end of the first century, but for first century readers, it would have pointed to a future time when the Romans used them, because Rome did not yet use the diadem of the Oriental monarchs at the end of the first century. The Roman emperors at that time just wore the gilded, they were covered with gold, but they were a laurel wreath crown, an adaptation of the laurel wreath in its natural state that was awarded to the victors of athletic games or the victors in warfare. And the Cretan dynasty is partly identified in the first seal by the fact that they wore that Stephanos laurel wreath crown and not a diadem. The crowns, the horns here in chapter 12 are not yet diadem. The horns do not have these diadems upon them, since the heads here are named before the horns and the diadems are on the heads. Now, in chapter 13, verse 1, we see a change has taken place. In chapter 13, verse 1, the horns are in the condition of becoming regal, and so they're named before the heads, and they wear the diadems there. So we're going to see a change by the time we get to the end of this chapter and the beginning of the next one. Heaven, as mentioned here, is the second heaven. It is referring to the idea of political elevation. I don't think it has anything to do with going to heaven as we think of it. But it's the idea of political elevation. You've got heaven and earth, and to be lifted up in the sky or like cloud-like is the idea of being politically elevated, as indicated by the luminaries in it. They represent human governmental powers. The sun is in the second heaven. That's the place where the planets are. The sky, or the second heaven, represents the sphere of temporal influence, and the stars are influential leaders in the churches, I think, as they were back at the end of chapter 1. Seven stars in the Lord's right hand were the representatives of the seven churches, the ones who were to read the letters to the churches. So it's the heaven of political elevation, and the Roman dragon wars against the church in a third of the empire. This is the closing spasm of the Roman dragon's pagan persecution of the church. The childbirth metaphor seems to involve the establishment of some corporate entity. It refers to a future event from the Patmos Revelation. The birth of the child seems to be the establishment of some corporate entity analogous to Isaiah's forecast in Isaiah 66, verses 6 through 17, where Zion in labor, there, back in Isaiah 66, Zion in labor gives birth to a man-child. This child in Revelation 12 would rule the nations with a rod of iron. Verse 5, the scepter was an ancient symbol of kingly authority, and it was an adaptation of the shepherd's crook. We have numerous examples archaeologically that we found of the shepherd's crook. Several shepherd's crooks coated with gold were found in King Tut's tomb. Normally these were ceremonial shepherd's crooks, but they could be used to beat a victim. They had a number of uses. An iron scepter was used to execute with absolute authority. You didn't coat it with gold if it was going to really be used to rule with authority. So the iron scepter says that this means business. This language is also applied to the church in chapter 2, verse 27, in the letter to one of the letters to the seven churches, the letter to Smyrna, I think. Here in chapter 12, verse 5, it seems to indicate that the church would give birth to an entity that would come to exercise authority. The child, the man-child, was snatched up to God and to his throne. In other words, elevated. This is as John is seeing it. You know, these are not things that really happened. Rather, information is given, and John sees it depicted in front of him. Like when he saw the smoke coming out of the horse's mouth, it was really rifles, muskets being fired between the ears of the horses, and it looked like the smoke was coming out of their mouths. So we're dealing here with how it appeared to John as he saw it depicted or visualized in dramatic tableau before him. So caught up to God and to his throne isn't what it sounds like to us if we're taking it literally. This is not literal language. It's symbolic. This is elevation to a position that was recognized by a government. Caught up in the second heaven, the idea of the symbolic second heaven, dedicated, a government that was dedicated to God and his church as they understood it. That is a theocratic kingdom. This snatching up of the male child would save it from being devoured by the dragon. Believers who were experiencing or expecting persecution would see in the birth or the elevation of the male child a hope for deliverance. The woman's flight into the wilderness is the opposite of this catching up to heaven that we just read about. Just the opposite of that. The authorities within the church, within the true church, were going to reject the position of authority that's indicated by heaven here. They're going to say that this is not God's will for the church to be connected with the state. The authorities within the true church would be very trepidatious about that. The crown with 12 stars is the diadem crown. The diadem consisted of two strands of braided gold adorned with pearls and precious gems. And we're told here that there appeared a great wonder in heaven. This suggests a thing that the thing being predicted was going to be amazing. It was going to be highly extraordinary and completely unanticipated. This is the first time in the book of Revelation that we're told that there was a wonder in heaven. It appears several more times, but this is the first one that this is called a sign or a wonder. And I think the reason is because this was so unexpected. Here you got the church being persecuted, and suddenly it's going to be caught up and going to be in a favored position. And the rest of the chapter gives us more detail about this. The casting down of the dragon refers to the fall of the satanic pagan power. It was going to lose its position of dominion. And we've seen that happened during the time of Constantine. It indicates that the satanic pagan power was going to lose its position of dominion over the empire, and that Satan was going to have to resort to other means, maybe more clandestine means, to continue to make war against the church. So far, he's been making war against the church openly, just blatantly. Nero burned Christians to light up his nighttime garden parties. It was just openly and blatantly done by pagan emperors. But now, Satan was going to have to finesse it and massage it and use a little more care in his tactics. The casting down of the satanic power, which was pagan Rome, was cause for great rejoicing in verses 10 and 12. The birth pangs of the woman, I think, represent the sufferings of the persecuted church during the time just preceding this birth in verse 11. When cast down, Satan's going to continue his warfare against the people of God, but he'll have to do it in a different way. The martyrs overcome Satan's designs by bearing witness unto death. They did not love their lives so much as to shrink from death, as he says in verse 11. The dragon pursues the woman who gave birth to the child. He's not pursuing the child now. He's pursuing the woman who gave birth to the child. These are two very different entities. The woman is providentially enabled to flee into the wilderness, where she would be protected from the dragon for 1260 days or years. That ties the chronology of this passage with Daniel 7:25, which also talks about the same amount of time, and with Revelation 11:3, which talks about the same amount of time. This is the period of the war of the little horn against the saints. This is the period of the two witnesses and their war with the beast. These verses indicate divine providence in providing for the survival of God's true church during the long struggle against the anti-Christian power. The language recalls Israel's escape from Egypt into the wilderness of Sinai, where she was nurtured by God with manna from heaven. The wilderness suggests a state or a condition rather than her moving places geographically. It means she's in a particular state or a condition rather than a physical location. The wilderness is an antonym for the word heaven in this chapter. It's just the opposite of it. Physical persecution is one of Satan's tactics, and was even before he was thrown down, and later he continues it under the beast, but under the beast he's going to pretend to be a Christian entity, but persecuting the true Church of God. The association of both John the Baptist and the Qumran community of Essenes with the desert may have suggested to the original readers that the true church would flee from doctrinal errors that might invade the newly elevated church. So they eventually were forced to dissociate from it to preserve a true witness to the gospel. This happened gradually and over time. But the Essenes had fled from Jerusalem into the Judean wilderness to escape the corruptions of the Jerusalem establishment and to preserve the true doctrines and the priestly rites as they understood them. For them, the desert was a symbol of their perceived orthodoxy and purity. It may have had the same meaning here to the people who originally read this. The flood, proceeding from the serpent's mouth, portrays his attempt to destroy the church by deception and false teaching. It's deception and false teaching that comes out of the mouth. We were singing that song that Ben led a while ago, and it reminded me of the 59th chapter of the book of Isaiah. When the enemy shall come in like a flood, the Spirit shall lift up a standard against him. That's what that song was all about. Obviously, whoever wrote that song had spent some time in Isaiah 59. The Spirit of the Lord shall lift up a standard against him. There is a distinction here between the woman and her offspring. And I think this is very important. Between the woman and the rest of her offspring. The woman is the symbol for the church at the time of her giving birth to the male child. And the offspring are those who had subsequently been born to the woman. Their description at the end of the chapter, as those who obey God's commandments and hold to the testimony of Jesus, suggest faithful believers in faithful congregations, in distinction from merely nominal members who were not really converted. The reference to the rest of the woman's offspring in distinction from the male child would hardly be appropriate if the male child was a reference to Christ. If the male child is Jesus, who is the rest of her offspring? For the rest of her offspring to be human beings, other mere human beings, might seem to demean the uniqueness of Jesus by putting the male child in the same category as ordinary human beings. Anyway, we're told in verse 7 that there was war in heaven. And heaven here, again, indicates the sphere of political ascendancy. This derives from the common association of the cosmic heavenly bodies with the pagan gods. They had a god called Mars, who was the god of war, and now we've got a star up in the sky, that, or a planet in our solar system, that has that same name. And this was, although some of these names weren't given until much later on, the idea was still there, that what you see in the sky represents these mythological stories that were not called mythological, as the stories were told then. It derives from the common association of these cosmic bodies with the pagan gods and with the authority of human rulers as well. If some king could take on the persona of Mars, then he could be worshipped as a god and people would be more likely to obey him. Michael is the archangel who protects the covenant people of God. We have this back in Daniel chapter 10, verse 21, Daniel 12, verse 1. The dragon and his angels lost their place in heaven, that is, the pagan dragon forces lost their political dominance in the empire. And we we've seen how this happened in the time of Constantine. That's when the great dragon was hurled to the earth. I do not believe that this can refer to the primordial fall or the original fall of Satan or any event that was already history when John wrote. Satan was already operating on earth when the prediction of things to come was given. So we have to take heaven and earth in this context as figurative expressions in harmony with the ancient use of celestial and terrestrial terms as authority metaphors. In verses 10 through 12, again, we have an interlude, a celebration of the victory of the church over the forces of evil. We're reminded of the souls of the martyrs crying from under the altar in the fifth seal. The earth and the sea are in distinction from the heavens here. This must be, in this context, indicating the temporal sphere in which Satan must act. He's deprived of the authority of the temporal state, and so now he's going to have to act in another sphere. He's going to have to go a little more underground, be a little more subtle about it. In verse 13, two wings of a great eagle given to the woman so that she could fly indicate God's providence in enabling his true church to find wilderness sanctuary. The torrent or the flood reflects the common circumstances in the eastern Mediterranean world. You can be in a dry stream bed or a wadi. You might even pitch your tent there because it looks like a good place to camp. And then a distant rain someplace far off that you don't even know about causes a torrent of water to come flooding down that wadi and sweep your tent away and everything else. This is a fairly common occurrence in that part of the world. It seemed like a dry travel lane, but suddenly here's water all around. You've seen flash floods in Missouri. I have, as a boy especially, up on the farm. Remember, we'd have a flash flood, and suddenly you could go out and swim in the pasture. There'd be water up to your knees. You could get down and swim in it. There'd be fish in it, but the water would be gone by noon. It's a flash flood. It just shows up for a while, and then it's gone. That seems to be the idea here. We've observed that the little scroll message is generally independent in its chronology from the message of the seven sealed scroll. Chapter 11 dealt with the witnesses of the martyrs during the centuries of apostasy. Chapter 12 is focusing on the time when the dragon power, that is the pagan Roman Empire, wore the diadem. And that dates it for us. The diadem was first worn as a Roman ensign by the Emperor Aurelian in 272 to 275 AD. Later, the Emperor Diocletian institutionalized the diadem as his imperial crown in the year 293 AD. Prior to that time, the laurel wreath was still ordinarily used, but Diocletian institutionalized the diadem in 293. So this is the era of time that this must be talking about. The introduction of the diadem crown was part of a new constitution introduced by Diocletian. Diocletian completely refurbished the political, military, and economic structure of the Roman Empire. This was such a big change that Gibbon goes so far as to call Diocletian a second Augustus and calls Diocletian the founder of a new empire rather than the restorer of the old empire. The reign of Diocletian was one of the great milestones in the history of the Roman Empire. His new imperial constitution was the imperial philosophy that Constantine also adopted. It came just shortly before the birth of the state church under Constantine, and Constantine adopted this new constitution. It made huge changes in the empire. For instance, it changed the 101 Roman provinces that they had had for centuries, changed that into larger units called dioceses, of which there were only 12. And Diocletian was the one who originated this, and then Constantine picked it up. Everything in the empire was tightened up structurally. There remained only one imperial civil service with strictly ordered hierarchies, tightened everything up, and helped the Western Roman Empire to survive for almost two more centuries, whereas otherwise it would not have. The church is being clothed with the sun indicates her recognition by the governing power, the Roman state, by which she was going to be soon emancipated from bitter persecution. I think this chapter, this 12th chapter, is about that. I'll give you a little history about it, Lord willing, when we begin tomorrow evening. Just a little history about how this came about. I'll do it that as sparsely as possible because it's very specific and detailed, and I know, even if you like history, I mean, I like history, but five or six guys slugging it out to see who's going to be top dog in the Roman Empire is not my idea of a good time, and I don't think it's yours either. So I'll just give you that as sparsely as I can, but I think we need just a little of it. I'll give you as little of it as I think we can get by with, and we'll see how this man-child, this entity, this state church comes about and how it gets separated from the true church of the Lord's people. It's a fascinating story. I personally think the 12th chapter is the hardest chapter of Revelation to teach just because of the detail of it, and it's detail that we're not particularly interested in ordinarily. But we'll do the best we can with that, Lord willing, tomorrow evening. Thank you so much for your kind and good attention. Do we have an